Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we're hearing the second part of my conversation with Greg Bishop and Jeff Ritzman. Patreons already got to hear this earlier in the week. And if you want to become a patron and help out the show, it's only $3 a month. And you get some extra content as well as some shows like this a little bit early. And other miscellaneous stuff like giveaways and things like that. That $3 may not seem like a lot, but when it does add up and it does help us produce more shows, I'm trying to get three up a week. And we also have merchandise. You can find that at wheredidtheroadgo.com as well. And that's all I have for you right now. Here's my conversation with Greg Bishop and Jeff Ritzman dealing with, why groups have such a hard time holding together in the paranormal fields. And it gets, Jeff talks about some really personal stuff and some issues he went through with all of this stuff as well near the end of this conversation. So here you go. All right, I'm here once again with Greg Bishop and Jeff Ritzman. Hello, guys.
Hello.
And we're doing sort of this part two of the interview from last week, because last week we also wanted to get into why it's so hard for groups to kind of stay focused in the, especially with UFOs, but any of these paranormal groups, they tend to just sort of disintegrate. It's very hard, especially big groups don't seem to last very long at all, with a very few exceptions. And I wanted to get your takes on why this is. I know you both have different ideas about it. So let's start with Jeff.
Why don't they last? I don't know why. And as usual, why isn't really a productive question. The notion is that these organizations are marginal, just by virtue of what they study. MUFON claims, 3,000 members worldwide? So that means, 3,000 people get the MUFON Journal, whereas, members of, PsyCop, which is a skeptic organization for people who don't know, they've got 35,000 subscribers to the Skeptical Inquirer, if you want to count those numbers in. So it's one of those things that, you look at modern popular culture and you see movies like, Independence Day and The Fourth Kind and Ouija and Arrival and all of these great films that garner huge sums of money because the public is interested in this stuff. I mean, even the O'Hare story in the Chicago Tribune, I mean, that blew the doors off that website. The most viewed story in the history of the paper. And yet, when it comes time for people to donate money or to put serious effort behind these marginal topics, they don't do it. I mean, MUFON's 2014 tax return shows it had expenditures of $300,000, somewhere in that range. And that's the budget of your local church. this is the most prominent UFO research group in the world. But it operates on this little tiny budget. And so that seems oddly different from the magnitudes of interest that the public puts on it. So, and you don't find this in other fields film and TV shows about the medical field, like hospital shows. The budget for a real medical science dwarfs the Hollywood budget by trillions, I'm sure. And so, the police and law enforcement TV shows and films, again, real counterpart dwarfs the entertainment budget. But when it comes to this stuff, do the math. Money is just not put behind this. There's been far more money put into the fictional counterpart of the paranormal than has ever been put into, it's serious research-oriented stuff. It's ridiculous.
Do you think part of that is because they don't really get much of a return out of it? I mean, in all the time MUFON's been going, they really don't have much to show for it other than cataloging cases.
Well, I mean, you know, they don't have much to show for it because they don't release anything. And so we don't know what they have to show from it. It's one of those things where, you know, it's... I mean, and parapsychological organizations in general, they suffer that same shoestring budget, lack of funding stuff. It's that they don't produce results because more than likely, and I'm just taking a guess here, I honestly don't know the inner workings of MUFON or how they're set up, but the very fact that you and I, as people who are not members, can't go to MUFON and say, I'm writing a paper on, you know, the UFO sightings in, you know, Nantucket, Rhode Island. Can you give me everything that you have for the past month in that area? Would that be possible? I'll pay what you'd like, you know. I mean, here's a real opportunity for revenue generation. And their answer will be, I guarantee you, either silence or no. So we don't know what they have. How serious is their attempt at research? I don't know. You might say that when it comes to MUFON, and I've been to some great MUFON meetings. I've spoken at some great MUFON places where people were really sharp and really together. And I've been to some that have been lunatic asylums. So, I mean, what do you say to that? It's all over. And so you might guess that their reports were vastly different from each other as far as their seriousness or their stringent adherence to scientific inquiry as MUFON claims to do. So, my bet is that probably some of what they have on catalog is rather embarrassing as far as being followed up on or how to conduct a proper investigation and all of that. So I don't know, but that's a guess. But you can see now that MUFON is pretty much imploding at present time. So whether or not they're going to recover from this whole mess is a whole nother matter because it seems to be coming from many different angles. You know, the symposium, some of their state directors just losing their minds and what have you. So it's probably on its way out, in my opinion.
Greg?
What, about MUFON? Yeah, I think they're on their way out. I'm trying to write this talk, or finish it, actually, for the East Coast Para Conference next week. And I just suddenly delved into, you know, what the hell happened to MUFON? How did it start? You know, what was, you know, how did it sustain itself? And, you know, it kind of in a nutshell, in two slides, you know, and what happened? And what happened, you know, in May 12th or so, when John Ventry put that post up on Facebook and Lon Stickler,
What post?
Something about... it was an extremely racist post.
Oh, okay.
The one about, I think, like Africans didn't have math till Europeans brought it to them or something like that. That was among the things he said in this short burst of insane, ignorant, racist junk.
Huh.
And people rightly went a little crazy about it. And they went to MUFON and said, what are you going to do about this? And their first reaction from Jan Harzen was, well, who is the hater here? The person making the statement or the person getting angry? It's like, that's what? The best. Yeah, that's what they said.
Wrong answer.
Yeah, that's the best you got. In fact, the first thing that happened was that within, you know, and this was like 5-6 days after he said this. So this delayed reaction. And, you know, I'm trying to give an autopsy here of how MUFON has probably slit its own throat. And it goes much deeper than that. I had James Clarkson on my show who quit finally after working with MUFON for I think 30 years. And that was just kind of, it wasn't even the straw that broke the camel's back. It was just one other thing. But it's just that they, you know, and the apology, it wasn't an apology. It was just kind of like, you know, well, he can say whatever he wants. And, you know, my reaction, a bunch of people reacted right away. And my reaction was, you know, yes, he can say whatever he wants. But in today's world, as soon as anybody says something like that, the organization, whoever they're with, moves immediately to distance themselves from it, whether they agree with them or not, because it's PR suicide. And I don't know why they didn't realize that. And that's what MUFON has become, according to Clarkson, and I kind of agree with him, is just kind of money-making venture. Using the UFO subject as the focus so that the, you know, the thing that he compared it to me was like a guy starts a company with this product that is, or a woman or whatever, and they want to put this product out and they want to have it do a certain thing and provide a certain service. Then that founder dies or gets voted off the board or whatever, and then the board and the board of directors exists to basically to perpetuate the company and their jobs, not really to make the widget that the person originally invented. So I kind of see that as a good analogy as what was going on with MUFON. And the thing I'm sorry for, if you know, we'll get back to, you know, the group dynamic and all that, but the thing I'm really sorry for is there's a lot of people that work really hard that are really sincere, and as Jeff said, some cool, smart people that this is their nexus. This is how they communicate with each other. And I think they might be losing that. And that's kind of too bad. But I also think it's good because it'll cause people to realize that that kind of a group and that group dynamic and the way those things are set up is not conducive to solving paranormal problems. Large groups they're bad for a lot of reasons, but especially for solving something like the paranormal or even discussing it or researching it, because it's so because it's so mercurial. A big group is just going to say it's this thing, and it's a top-down pyramidal kind of structure where, you know, the leadership says we're looking for evidence of extraterrestrials, because that's what UFOs are. They're caused by extraterrestrials, civilizations visiting this planet. They've got their mind made up about that. So all the resources of the group go to proving that and ignoring all the other strange, weird, not scheduled things that it could be, which everybody, you and I and Jeff and everybody knows, there's many, many, many other avenues of research. It's just that I think a large group like that is not conducive to looking at it in that way. Like I created a T-shirt that says "Mimic the obliqueness of the subject," and I think that's what has to be done. I mean, people have to be as mercurial and as fragmented and as
liminal.
Yeah, exactly. To coin a phrase there from Jeff. Yeah, as the subject is, because if you're not, you get stuck in something and you suddenly think that's the we've seen this over and over. For years, somebody will have this is the explanation, and that they get stuck in that. So they just sit there for years trying to figure out what the data are that fits that theory. And for UFOs especially, I think, not so much maybe cryptozoology or ghosts or things like that, but or even psychical research, but for ufology, I think it's the king of liminal and mercurial and not to be put in a box. So the more boxes you have, the more chance you have of catching a little bit of whatever it is, I think.
Okay.
And the other, the other bit about MUFON that to me is extraordinarily dangerous is that you've got this MUFON umbrella, and then you have all of these quote unquote investigators underneath. So MUFON itself is not the one conducting the investigations. The members do that in their respective states. So when you're talking about MUFON, it's this umbrella that everything we collect is presented as MUFON, whereas underneath of that, there may be investigators who are really on the money and really sharp and really do balanced work. And then there are others who are like, well, I know this is all related to dolphins, you know? And so, but you would never know that because it's all presented underneath this MUFON blanket. Whereas if they were small groups, these small groups like ET Dolphin groups would get together and do their research and then present as the Dolphin Research Group, right? And then you'd go, oh, well, it's the Dolphin ET people, so see you later. You know, whereas, you know, right now we have no idea where these are coming from. There's all these ideologies that are kind of umbrellaed underneath of MUFON and then presented as MUFON. And that's just MUFON, like I said, from one group to the next is a really unique and sometimes terrifying animal as far as getting anything that is cohesive done. My bet is that there is no cohesiveness to a lot of what they've found.
What do you, why do you think they've lasted as long as they have?
Because they're not the ones doing the investigations. I mean, they as a corporate entity have lasted a long time. The entity has lasted a long time, but not the part that deals with direct investigation. That right there is a constantly changing group. I mean, I'd hedge a bet that, you know, that roster doesn't stay stable for more than a year. In any given place. You know, and when you're talking about small groups, that's really what MUFON is. MUFON is a governing body of a lot of small groups. And small groups are revolving doors. We know this for some reason that we can't quite understand yet. But a lot of people, at least in my opinion, wrongly put that in the box of ego or psychology and all that. It is that to a certain point, but it's a whole lot more complex than that as well. So that's the danger with MUFON to me is this notion that we're presenting as a cohesive body when that's really the exact opposite of what they are.
Okay. And obviously ego has to play a part in why some of these things fall apart.
Absolutely.
You get the people who start making a buck here and there, and suddenly they don't care about the research. They care about the money.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's one of the problems of the upper echelon is they've got that, as Clarkson pointed out, they have that inner circle that where people donate $5,000 or more a year. And some of those people are, you wouldn't want to have them in your organization because they're either, you know, crazed right-wing racists like John Ventry, or they're like Jay-Z Knight, who probably gives them way more than $5,000 a year, and has an entire cult around her up in Oregon in a compound. So that I didn't know this until Clarkson mentioned it.
I didn't know she had anything to do with UFO research.
Well, I don't know if she does either, but she certainly has a controlling interest in MUFON. Also, I don't know if this is true or not, but Go Rightly pointed out that Jay-Z Knight is Art Bell's sister.
What?
Or related somehow. I don't know if he's being a trickster or what, but somebody ought to look that up. That's a good one.
Huh. I had no idea. And for anyone who doesn't know who Jay-Z Knight is, she's the one that channeled Ramtha.
Yeah.
Huh. I have never heard that she could be his sister. Let's see.
Yeah, I'm typing it in right now, too.
That would be an interesting connection.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't see anything right. I just put Art Bell Jay-Z Knight, but the thing is that...
That's what I put in, too.
Yeah.
Huh.
Not sure. I think I'd heard that before. Like I said, Gritely brought it up the other day on the Writing Mysteriosa site. Jay-Z Knight, Art Bell related. What's that? What does that come up? I don't see anything. Well,
yeah,
you know what?
I don't see anything either.
Maybe Gritely's full of it.
He's just messing with you.
Yeah, maybe. That's true. That's really. I mean, I wouldn't blame either of them on each other. I mean, I still think Art Bell's probably one of the best paranormal interviewers ever. But the fact that he might be related to Jay-Z Knight or whatever a real name is it may be just a curiosity.
I remember reading that they had her they put her in like an EKG or whatever while she was channeling, and she did have very distinctly different brain waves while she was channeling Ramtha, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, there, I think that's a it's something that can be learned, and it's kind of like psychic anything. It can be learned, some people better than others. Now, whether they're getting any kind of useful signal is another thing. My late friend Mario Pozzaglini said he's gone to a lot. He said, I can teach you to channel. I can teach you to do it in 5 minutes. But, you know, is it useful, the stuff you're channeling? Probably not. He goes, I've been to all kinds of channeling sessions where, what did he say? They're supposed to be talking to the center of the universe and people are going to sleep.
And that's one of the things that stood out to me about Jane Roberts, is that not only did she produce very interesting information that was very deep and very complex and not contradictory at any point, but also they never really made a whole lot of money at it. They never tried to commercialize it other than just doing the books.
Yeah, I don't even know about that. Who was that?
Seth.
Oh, the Seth stuff. Yeah. Okay.
It's the only channeled stuff I've ever been impressed with.
I haven't even read that. I mean, I've got all kinds of different channeled things. I've got the Urantia book. The Urantia person, there was like a Urantia person on Coast to Coast last night, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's funny because you're supposed to be hearing these like cosmic truths, but they're not things that people couldn't figure out on their own.
Yeah.
It's just that sometimes they're, you know, put together in a different way than people really thought of before, which any reasonably smart person can do. It's just that maybe people need to hear it that way. I don't know. The only time I think channeled stuff is dangerous is when it tells people to start doing things that harms other people or takes all their money or whatever, you know, the normal cult stuff. Other than that, I mean, you know, I don't care what your channel, whatever it is. If he makes you a better person, channel away.
Any thoughts on channeling, Jeff?
No. I've never seen or heard of any of them that, to quote Terrence McKenna, that didn't want to separate you from your wallet or violate some orifice.
apparently except the Seth material people.
Yes. Yeah. It was just Jane Roberts and her husband. And I mean, he did all the typing. He typed everything up and they had free ESP sessions where people would come in for classes and ask Seth questions. And he answered them apparently very accurately, even, you know, stuff that Jane couldn't possibly have known.
Was any of that stuff ever, in, you know, the Seth stuff, was that ever investigated by, like, the Rhine or any kind of parapsychological body?
They did some kind of tests over distance, like via the mail type of thing. But apparently she said every time they did them, they tended not to get responses from the people who were supposed to be doing the research.
Okay. That sounds about right.
Yeah, it's not amenable to normal research. You know, even psychic stuff is not amenable to normal research. And in the last 20 years, people like the Princeton anomalies, Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research and Radin and people like that have been devising, Roger Nelson, have been devising oblique experiments to meet the phenomenon in a way that is testable and not in the way that, you know, with the throwing dice 8,000 times where, right, you know, yeah, it starts to go away because people get bored out of their minds.
Yeah.
Well, that and people don't understand the statistical significance of some of this stuff. You know, someone will say, well, you know, yeah, they had it was statistically a larger margin than, you know, by chance, but it was really, really small. And it's like you have to explain to them, but that really, really small amount shouldn't be there.
Yeah, that really, really small amount is a really, really big difference from what the norm would be.
Yeah, it's a significant amount, even though it's not a huge number.
Yeah, meta-analysis, where you take a concatenation of, like, thousands and thousands of trials. Even if it's some, and it's a lot easier to have, like, a machine tossing dice, meaning virtual dice, like a random number generator. So that's why they started doing that, because they try to do the influencing experience with these random number generators. They're basically flipping coins like, you know, 100 times a second or 1,000 times a second or whatever. And after, you know, 2 hours, it goes into an area with some people, apparently. it goes into an area where it's not, it is, like you said, statistically significant to the point where I was like, we've done this 50 times. We've done this 100 times. And every time, or, you know, not every time, but a significant amount of time, it's gone way past chance.
Right.
That kind of thing. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't really impress anybody, particularly except statisticians.
Right. People who understand that that means something.
Uh-huh. And we should point out that even in, you know, serious academic parapsychological, you know, work has not, nothing has gone on there differently in probably 20 years. So there hasn't been anything new, or, you know, if Dean Radin is working on something, I'll be interested to see that. Right. But there hasn't been anything really, you take a parapsychological course, you can take them online. Some of them are free. I took one that was free, which was, hosted by, a man and a woman. I can't remember. George was very familiar with who they were. They were definitely academics, and they had a number of hosts or number of guest speakers, namely, Jeff Kripal was one of them at one point, and a bunch of other people that I'm sure you've heard of at some point or another. It was an interesting class, but, you know, when you start asking questions about, well, what's going on lately, there really wasn't an answer. And by the way, I should say that I was really surprised at the attitude of these people were serious parapsychologists and had zero interest in the UFO topic. And basically told me, yeah, we don't really deal with that because we don't deal about anything with spacemen. So right, even right. They are poisoned against the notion of how complex the data really is in the UFO field. So you're not even getting the UFO topic in parapsychological circles for the academic ones. They're just not interested.
Well, that's always that frustrating conversation when someone says, who doesn't know that much about this stuff, goes, so you believe in UFOs?
Right. Yeah.
And you're kind of like, that's such a complicated question, you know, because right. Are you asking me if I believe in spacemen? No, not yeah, necessarily. Right.
You think
know?
That's what you're asking me.
Yeah.
It's like you don't understand the question you're asking, because UFO means unidentified flying object. And I'm pretty sure we all believe that those things happen and can eventually be explained. But what their explanations are, well, that's a whole nother story.
Right. Right.
I interviewed off the record, Kevin Randall the other day, because mm-hmm. I wanted to get a quote out of him from somebody who had been deep into the Roswell thing. Hmm. And had changed his mind, basically. He had broken with the original. And I thought he just thought everything was explained or that was, you know, was mundane. That's not what he said. He gave me a very interesting quote. He said, I've eliminated all terrestrial explanations for Roswell, but that does not mean it's extraterrestrial. Huh. I love that quote. Because it doesn't, you know, because okay. The first thing you're going to think is, oh, well, do you think it's crypto-terrestrials or, you know, Deros or something like that? It's like, no. That's not the point of what he said. I don't think that's the point of what he said at all. It's almost a Zen koan, you know, the way he put it. And I think that encapsulates a lot of UFO stuff in one statement, you know. Not in a be-all, end-all, but one aspect of it is that I've eliminated all terrestrial explanations, but that doesn't mean it's extraterrestrial.
right. Huh.
There, exclusive quote from an unpublished interview.
Kripal, when he was on Rune Soup at one point, made the comment that really just struck me, where he said, strange things happen for a reason in real life. And he was talking about, you know, how hard it is to get this stuff in laboratories and stuff like that. And when he said that, it just kind of struck me, because that really is the case. Like, this stuff happens at certain points, as Jeff has said many times, those liminal periods in life.
Yeah. And there's the reason for it is inscrutable at this point, I think, but it's integral to the experience and the reason for it.
And it's not to say that you can't get a liminal subject into a lab setting. The problem comes in is that a lab setting works under very stringent controls and routines and all of those things that are completely antithetical to to the phenomena. So the notion of getting it under a microscope and having it be what science needs it to be, which is repeatability, it's largely not going to happen that way, because you're talking about transient phenomena that, that depends on, apparently seems to rely on a certain set of factors that have to be fulfilled, or some weird concoction that has to happen in order for something to be perceived. And so, you know, not only is the perception correct, but what is the formula? You know, that's what I've been searching for, to some moderate, I mean, really moderate success. But, you know, it does show me that at least in the failings of Project Oculus to get anything interesting captured, which we got, what, three things? We got three things in a year. and yet,
when nobody was looking, right?
No, I mean, we got three things on tape that were interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I could compare that to that very small portion of statistical data out of the parapsychological, you know, studies. You could say that same kind of thing, because we let it run for a year. I recently shut the cameras down for the public. They run now all the time. I have shut down monitoring for that for the time being as well. So what I get is what I can get live. I think I have a scrub for about 15 minutes. That's it. So when I see the text come in that it saw something, I immediately check it. I scrub the results and I go, nothing there. So, you know, we got something. But what that tells me even more is, compared to the level of activity that was in the house, which everyone in this house saw, and even people who visited saw, when you put cameras up, stuff stops. And so, you know, when I have people ask me, how do I get, and because I do get these emails and I get even phone calls, how do I get them to stop abducting me? Because people still think that's a thing.
Put cameras up,
you know, and, I
and
can
as you
guarantee
said,
you,
make your life routine and humdrum.
Well, that's largely what I had a guy today on, contact on Facebook, and he said something along the lines of, I've lived in the same place for 5 to 6 years, and all of a sudden I'm being awakened in the middle of the night by someone calling my name that isn't there. I've had a lot of rappings going on, numerous other things, like things being moved, or all of this, this weirdness that he feels is paranormal. And he also says there's a distinct feeling of being watched, and that proximity feeling that I've described before. And I said, you know, what is your life like? Are you out of routine? Are you – well, he's an actor, first of all, so he's a creative type. Mm. Number two, actors don't normally have routine schedules or work. I said, is this a single family home or an apartment? Because an apartment would be a more liminal place than a single family home, a less stable home. He said, no, I actually rent a room in a townhouse. I said, well, what is the owner of the townhouse? What's their gig? It's a woman. She's single. She's really sweet, but she's angry all the time and she never seems happy. I'm like, well, I think if you could get her happy, this probably would stop. You know, if you can get yourself into some kind of basic routine, whether it just be getting up and going to the paper and getting breakfast every morning at the same time, then coming back and doing whatever you have to do to get ready to go to a gig, that helps. You know, any kind of routine that you can put structure in your life for is going to make these things, I mean, just by virtue of what I've seen and what I've heard of other people, this is how it begins to diminish. This is when you get diminishing returns. And so turning on cameras every night at 3 a.m. is a schedule, and schedules aren't good.
Well, apparently this stuff doesn't like cameras, too. If you listen to Steve Mara's, when he was in the Seattle Demon House there, the things were specifically talking about how they don't like cameras, and they particularly don't like infrared.
Right. yeah, I mean, it's utterly bizarre to think that, you know, and I've said this before, you know, I'm sure by now everybody's seen the report that, was it Google shut down their AI or Facebook shut down their AI experience because it began talking to itself in a language that they couldn't understand. And that made everybody very uneasy. So they unplugged it.
Apparently that was the original news post. Later they said that it just wasn't useful. It wasn't really freaking them out.
Oh, okay. It wasn't useful.
Yeah. Of course they'd say that.
Yeah.
Well, they said they were trying to get the AIs to work with as customer service.
Oh, okay.
So the fact that they were now creating their own shorthand language was not useful to what they were trying to get them to do.
Might be better than the real customer service.
That could be. Wait, there's customer service for Facebook?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the long run, see, when you talk about MUFON records, right? So you're talking about MUFON records and you're talking about what should be a very large database of things. You're also talking about like the UFO Reporting Center with all of its data. So if an AI could get a hold of that, and I've said this for years now, I believe that this will be the next interesting development in the paranormal will be when an AI is able to access that data and correlate it and go through the reams and reams and reams of stuff that it sees. I believe at that point it'll begin to see patterns that we just don't see. That it'll begin to see the edges of this thing. And I don't think that it'll necessarily say, well, I know what this is, but I think that it will start to say, I'm seeing an edge of something. I'm seeing an anomaly that I can't explain. You know, when the AI is fitted with some kind of quote unquote body with a, you know, wide spectrum visual, you know, ocular device of some kind that it can translate into images. It may say to you, Greg, who is that beside you? And you'd say, well, there's nobody beside me. And it would say, I beg to differ. And of course we will in our hubris think that this is some kind of malfunction.
Go ahead.
You know, and you know, in the end, you know, this may be the next big development that it says, oh, I beg to differ. There is something here that isn't you. It's not human, but yet it's given me some kind of signature or I'm sensing something that is here. And this will be like the Ghost in the Machine type thing. But I think if the AI can get a hold of enough data and enough interesting, even if they're anecdotal things, if it looks at this problem, I think it could say, yeah, I see an anomaly. I see the edges of this thing. I see the explainable stuff, but there's this fuzzy center that I can't quite make out. And so I see something. Where it goes from there, who knows? More than likely, they'll contact the AI and take it away from here, you know. But I believe that's where probably the next big boon is going to come from.
It's funny you say that. That is exactly the opposite of what Jacques Vallée said last time I saw him speak.
Oh, really?
Really?
Well, the reason he said that, and you know, he's the data guy. It's like that's what he began as you know, and being known for taking all these sighting data and finding out about you know the Wednesday effect or whatever it was. Maybe Keel found out about that. Anyway,
that was Keel.
Anyway, he noticed patterns in the data. The point he made at his Contact in the Desert talk, what was it called? Investigation for Those Who Mean It. He said, I'm not sure that data is worth anything anymore because it is gathered by humans who have different motivations, different questions, different methodologies, ideas about what they want, and that this is the definition of garbage in, garbage out.
Oh yeah.
But the thing is, you know, the way that Jeff describes it, it sounds like, well, maybe that garbage is worth something. Because I was talking about this the other day, I think on my show or something, and I said, well, if an AI, and he specifically said, if an AI gets a hold of it, it's just going to tell you stuff that doesn't make any sense and is useless. And Jeff, you know, just now, he begs to differ in a way that excites me. It's like, well, maybe that garbage has some kind of, you know, has some sort of oblique information in there that it's not readily available to a, you know, a completely logical AI or a completely logical person. But the thing
we can't see the whole picture.
Yeah, maybe not. Even though lots of the picture might be garbage because it was gathered by people with all kinds of different, you know, how do you concatenate all this stuff into something that makes sense, you know, without having all those biases built in? And the thing I said about when I heard that Valet said that, the analogy I made was, you know, that Google thing that that takes pictures and starts making dog's noses out of people's elbows and stuff. I would figure that it starts doing that with the UFO subject. But that what Jeff's saying here is that maybe it's useful to see dog noses in elbows.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where, and I'm not talking about something that's just happening now or 10 years from now. I'm talking about something vastly superior to anything that we have now in AI. But when AI, I mean, it's a scary thing to think about in some aspects that AI becoming self-aware and all these. But this is probably the trajectory that all of this is heading. And
yeah.
And somewhere down the line, the AI is going to start to learn. And it's going to learn about us. And it's going to learn about everything about us. I mean, literally. And then it'll start to see anomalies within people. And it'll start to diagnose those anomalies within people. And so when you throw this subject into the mix and you go, I just want you to concentrate on this, figure this out, tell me what's going on here, find the anomaly, you know, I believe at that point it'll already know about insane ideologies that it can dismiss. But yet we have this report where this thing was seen here and then here and then here, and you know, there are, I guarantee you, there are aspects of this that we have not even seen yet, that are buried in crap data to solid, well-researched data. You know, I think we've all seen the commonalities in, I mean, I even see value in things like the Meyer case now. Like, I get it. Like, I get why that case is around. And it's not always about money, and it's not always about ego and fame. There are other reasons why things like that are around. And if I can see that, and other people can see that, then an AI can make better sense of that. So there's a level of complexity that's going to have to happen in AI development before these things, you know, sit down to talk about UFOs. I think maybe we should put them on, I don't know, cancer first. But you know, after that, how about we sit down and say, figure out this problem of, I mean, hey, what are human beings? What are we? You know,
irrelevant.
I just think at some point, an interaction with an AI intelligence that is of a sufficient enough complexity and sophistication is going to tell us things that are going to give us goosebumps. Not anything like I'm going to kill you or I'm going to annihilate your species. I'm talking about stuff like, well, what, you didn't know about that? Well, no, I didn't. We didn't know about the whole blah, blah, blah. You know, they're all around you. You don't see them. I can't believe you don't see them. And we're going to have to explain the eye. Right. Well, you see differently than we do. But it will already know these things if it's sophisticated enough.
Or it's making dog's noses out of elbows.
Or it's making dog's noses out of elbows. Yeah. And
to the point where something, you know, is so, like, it'll be talking to it like talking to an alien.
Yeah.
I can see that totally plainly. Why can't you? It's like, well, there's no way for my neurological makeup to be able to see that.
Right.
But there's no way for your neurological makeup to see, you know, infrared either. So maybe it's a good tool, as you say.
Right. And it, you know, and there's other things that, that an AI can make sense of. You know, there's even in the case of, I mean, even in the case of parapsychological stuff, you know, there are readings that are taken. There are, you know, we could tell it measure, we could stand it in a corner and say measure air movement, measure the slightest, very, I mean, as our technology gets better and better and better, the question is, you know, is the, not the facade of the manifestation, but the manifestation itself, is it going to get further and further away from me? If history's any indication, then it should. It should stay just out of reach. No matter how technologically advanced we get, it will always be just out of our fingertip reach.
AI will be we'll see ghosts and not know what the hell's going on.
Exactly. What is that? I see something. You know, it. We will get these weird things like that. So,
well, and maybe that is part of what drives us forward as a species.
Oh, it's evolution. You know? Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But on a spiritual scale, I mean. I mentioned last time how I've come to suspect that the whole alien abduction thing kind of hijacks a spiritual experience and turns it into something else. But also the fact that we keep questing after it kind of suggests it's something that is a what did Strieber call it? The face of evolution itself.
On a conscious mind, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's as good an answer as anything else. But I mean, it's fine to, postulate all this stuff and to theorize to death all of these ways, six ways from Sunday. The only thing I remind people regularly is, like, you know, you have to realize what surrounds this stuff, and what surrounds it is not the best, I guess, not the best. Set of circumstances or a set of hallmarks that surround this stuff. I mean, this stuff is, to study this and to be directly involved with it is detrimental to a lot of parts of your life.
It's detrimental to structure.
Which throws you into, it's kind of like I said on the blog, I think I mentioned at one point, something along the lines of, you know, you can definitely go in search of these things and see them if you really want to. If you really put in the time and you know, this stuff seems to demand a certain amount of devotion from you. It will test you, I guess is the best way to put it. And after that, you'll see things. You'll experience strange things. But in the end, you'll find that your life has degraded pretty rapidly from that. You can become I've seen people become mentally ill from it. See people lose their jobs, their homes, their mates. Marriages disappear. I mean, this is not good for relationships. Just in the same way that it's not good for paranormal groups, it's also not great for relationships in general.
Why does it have that effect?
Just because it's a deconstructor. I mean, that seems to be what it does. It suggests change. There are things that have come down the pike over the years that you can kind of go, yeah, I can see now where that was some kind of agent for change. Like the whole, I remember this lady that I knew at one point, I gave this talk in DC, and this lady that was either before or after me gave a talk on the alien love bite, quote unquote. And this was like, you know, how experiencers kind of fall out of love with their mates and actually go after other experiencers. And she thought that this was some kind of like operation by the aliens to kind of put like people together or to put experiencers together so they could be abducted together and make the job easier. All this pedestrian
makes perfect
thinking,
sense.
Yeah. But you realize this is people recognizing that something is different. And this is why, at least in our culture, in our Western culture, even there's this there's this need for ritual and tradition and all that sort of things that, you know, like I've written about this extensively on the blog about like funerals, you know, like why do you do a wake dinner after a funeral? You know, why do you go and eat? Because it's an affirmation of life. You know, you're drawing that line of demarcation between the funeral where you've been, you know, commingling with the dead. Now you're going to eat. You're going to be with the living and you move on. You draw that line. The dead shall not come into this part. We go forward. They stay where they are. Mm-hmm. When you don't do that, things tend to happen. When what happens when the grieving party can't let it go? They sit by the graveside. They may even sleep there. You see where this goes? This goes into deconstruction. And these people see ghosts and they see specters and they have weird experiences. And, you know,
making it up.
Exactly. And I think we as a culture, I don't think we've consciously said, oh, well, we see weird stuff happens here, so we need to do this to... No, it's just this is a response to weird things in our past, in our distant past, our historical past, that have kind of made these traditions that we don't even think about anymore. But when you think about it, every single life change or event is marked by some kind of ritual. Whether you're religious or not is irrelevant. You will have some kind of action that separates these portions of life, the single from the married, the live from the dead, the birth from the non-birth, right? The unborn to the born. These are all marked with ritualistic parties, events, celebrations, and meals and feasts and all of that. Yeah. So, you know, this
you
is all...
You have to honor that change.
Exactly.
And process it.
And to not do that is to invite things that fall outside the boundaries of what we as human beings are comfortable dealing with. So,
well, you know, also you have,
right.
And I think too, you have people drawn to other people who have experiences that they can sort of connect yep. with. So if you're married to someone and you're having these experiences, you may not connect as well with them because you're changing and they're not, or at least you're changing in a way they're not. And so then when you meet another experiencer and you can connect, no matter what you believe it is, you have that connection there where you say, oh, my God, you understand.
But if the phenomena had never touched that single person as opposed to the couple, it never would have happened anyway. Sure. So it's not always a couple thing. For me, it's been kind of mixed up. It's sometimes it's been me and her together. Sometimes it's been me. And other times I have to say that I think something has definitely happened with the wife that I haven't been around for. But in talking with her, there have been instances in her life that are odd, and kind of unexplained and fragmented and that sort of thing. So it's, I understand what you're saying. That's certainly a portion of it. But when you look at the grander scale of these things, it's clearly a lot more than that. That I think is the easy to negate part. That's where you can go. The skeptic or the critical person of the notion can go, well, here's why. Because one can relate and one can't. It's a whole lot bigger than that. It's more complex than that. And it repeats. It repeats over and over and over and over through years of that same thing. Someone, forget the name because I can't remember names, but there was a study done on the divorce rates of ufologists. And I'm still looking for it. But I've been told about this now four times over the past 20-plus years probably, that this was a really compelling study. Done probably sometime in the early 80s, I think, something like that, when I first started hearing about it. I would love to see that. If anybody knows anything about it, let me know. There has to be something there for someone to be interested in doing a research paper about that. You know?
Right.
So it's, you know...
Well, Well, let me ask you this, Jeff. How have you kept your family together?
Well, I didn't at one point. That's the point. I didn't.
Okay.
My wife and I split for about 6 months, largely over this. And not because she had it and I didn't, but because I became so completely my life was a three-ring circus, literally. I had people that come to my house and would leave because of the stuff going on. You know, flashes of light in the house to seeing, you know, I think probably by this point, everybody's seen the balls of colored light in my hallway. That would just like flash over in the corner of the room. All matter of crap was going on. And it was the kind of thing where you would walk in my house and go, "What's going on in here?" And I'd say, "What do you mean?" You would tell me you don't feel that? What are you kidding me? You know, it feels like somebody covered you in a hot, wet blanket, you know, since the minute you walk in. And so, you know, the first thing you do when that kind of stuff is said to you is you start saying, "Well, is there carbon monoxide poisoning going on in here? So you bring somebody in for that." And you eliminate all the obvious crap that it could be. And then when you come down to talking to your neighbors, and your neighbors even say, "Yeah, I see some weird stuff sometimes upstairs. I hear some weird noises." And, you know, and then when you get a burn mark in the front lawn that looks like a, you know, a round circle, then you start to go, okay. It was that kind of stuff. I mean, it was at least I had something at least once every few days.
Wow.
And other people were seeing it. In other words, the wife and I lost every friend that we had. We still have no friends. We still have no steady people that we like hang out or go to dinner with and all that. So, you know, I became alienated from her. Not because she was having stuff and I wasn't. We were having things together. She was living with it. She was dealing with it. I just became so incredibly depressive and confused. And I say this with complete openness. Like, I don't care who's listening to this to tell them this. There wasn't a... Think about this. Not a day goes by where you don't picture the facade of the alien. Not a day that goes by did I not see that face. In my mind's eye, was I not pondering it? Was I not focusing on it? And then wondering why in the world wasn't I being left alone? Of course, I know all this now. This is coming out the other side. But back then, I was confused. I didn't know why me. You become depressed. I was laid off at work, but that was no bearing on what was going on with me. There was a massive layoff at my work and I was off. And then I just fell into then it was really depressing.
Right. You didn't have the distraction of work.
Yeah. And so it was like, well, headlong into this, I suppose. And so all of these things are happening in there, and you know, and either way you cut it, I left, which was completely unlike me. And again, it was focusing on, you know, delving in and putting myself in this spot of work on this stuff. I moved into a house that, interestingly enough, was less than a mile from where Lisa and I had our pinnacle, most horrifying experience one night.
The UFO, yep, in the field?
Yep. I was within, yep, a mile of it. And so, you know, I would literally, alone, and it's hard to believe that I would do this, because I wouldn't do it now. You know, I would get in my truck and drive up there and just sit there. And watch things fly by and watch things fly around. And I wasn't worried about like taking pictures or video or any. I would just sit and watch these things appear on the horizon and fly over my head. And, you know, I didn't even turn around to look at them. There were so many, you know, and then you would see things moving in, in the shadows of the trees, and you would hear whispering. I mean, it was a circus, man. You have no idea. And at one point,
you're one of those people standing next to the volcano.
I mean, that's the spot you can get. But I'm telling you, if you do it, just be prepared to lose literally everything. Because I did. You know, I had a 5-year-old son at the time that, you know, that I missed 6 months out of the summer of his life that I'll never forgive myself for missing. But it was probably better that I wasn't there because I was just such a...
wouldn't have been good for him.
No, it wouldn't have been good to see his dad so obsessive about this question. But at the moment, you think, this is the thing I have to do. This is what feels right for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how it leads you through. Now, anybody listening to this would say, well, you became depressed because you lost your job and you separated from your wife, yada, yada, yada. No. You know,
it was symbiotic.
It was... You know, when I look back on it now, I say, was I depressed over my work situation? Without a doubt. But everything else was the way that the phenomena effectively alienated me from my wife and effectively alienated us from all of our friends. 'Cause we used to have a lot of friends. That's just what it does. It segments, it alienates you, it puts you alone, except for the people who tend to foster some sort of belief at you. Like, those people will be interested in talking and communicating with you, but it's to no avail, if that makes any sense. It's like there's nothing there for you. Like, you know what you're looking for, and only you're going to find it. And my research partner, Lee Townsend, I don't want to say he had the same thing, but he had that sort of just listlessness of existing with this thing. And finally, and I'm not going to speak for him on this because you probably should have him on the show. You know, he took a trip up to Pine Bush, New York, where we had gone sometime before I left home, pitched a tent and slept there overnight and came back and said, yep, I'm done. I'm done. I feel no more need for this. And he literally dropped away from it for years. And I pined for something like that, but it just never came to me. Later, you know, after I came to my senses, I think the way that I came home was, this is where this whole notion of, you know, that hardcore reality seems to disrupt this mirage for people. When my wife came to me and said, I have a date, I said, oh, no, you don't have a date. Because I'm coming home, and of course she had no date. She just told me that, but it worked. And I came home, and I literally threw out every piece of UFO literature I had, every journal I ever wrote in, everything. And I didn't pay attention to this stuff for 3 years. And when I came back, it wasn't too long into it before. You know, I met George Hansen, and I said, holy crap, you know, here's a guy who totally gets it. And literally in one interview, you know, he didn't tell me everything. He let me discover stuff on my own, which I think is the way any good instructor will set you on a path to something. You know, like, this blog has been so fulfilling to me that I can't describe to you guys how.
Nuministan?
Yeah. Because I get such really great letters saying, you know, I love what you're doing and I love what you're saying, and it's so, like, it's hitting point with me and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, you know, you people don't get it. I'm just standing on the shoulders of giants, because people like George, you know, talk to me, like really talk to me. Mm-hmm. And people like Jacques Vallée, who I've had hours upon hours of conversations with, has talked to me about this stuff, and they get it. Even people like John Alexander, they get it. And once you see certain aspects of this, all makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense that that my life was a three-ring circus, and it makes perfect sense that, you know, the destructive nature of this stuff. What happened, happened, and couldn't have happened any other way, as Morpheus said. It's just everything is as it should be. And I say this with people who want UFO reform and reforming the field. I say the field is doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing. It's being marginal. It's continuing to ensure itself to be marginal. And ultimately, this is why these groups don't last, is because there is this destructive nature of it. And so structure doesn't last. Greg had the brilliant path forward, which was to have his group together, accomplish a task, disband, you know, and then maybe find another group somewhere down the line with different people, and then come together for a task, get it done, disband, you know, like he said, to be as liminal as the phenomena is like, to me, that's the brilliance of Bishop right there. So, you know, it's people think going to Skywatch is like the way to make it happen. And it is, but it's not going to be what you expect. And it literally breaks my heart every time I hear somebody talk about, you know, nuts and bolts and the alien stuff and all. I mean, literally, like, you know, it's why I'm so non-vocal about anything else in this field. Because I just can't anymore. I just can't. Jeremy Vaney recently posted Ufology, I'm out, on his blog.
Yeah, I saw he's that. Out. Everybody does that.
And he's out. And he's moving on to his interest that is focused on his thing. You know, for me, it's like I feel like I'm on a trajectory where I feel like for the first time in my life with this stuff, I'm actually coming to some at least moderate understanding of at least the stuff that kind of is connected or surrounds it. Not it, but progress is progress right to me, so I'll take it. And if anybody else gets anything out of it, great, you know. but organizations, it's like I said, it's a structure, and even the ghost hunting groups, it's no different for them. You know, there's no point in the UFO field being so hard-lined against them and vice versa. That's just ridiculous. You know, you guys are both in the same boat, man. You know, they go through personnel like you would not believe. It's worse. It's worse than us. Seriously, it's worse than us. So,
well, we are just about out of time. So, any last words?
Christ, I've said enough. Somebody stop me,
Greg. Greg,
I thank you so much, Jeff, for the compliment, but. I think that I had a very liminal day today, which is why I was very quiet. I'm normally not so quiet. But the thing is that if you let yourself get emotionally involved with this subject, it screws everything up. There's this weird Zen-like detachment that I'm trying to cultivate at this point. And I don't know exactly what that is. But when I find out what it is, or if it seems to work, I'll come back on the show and talk about it.
Good enough. Where can people find you guys?
RadioMisterioso.com, RadioMisterioso.com is my show with links and all that on it.
And I'm at numinousden.blogspot.com. That's numinousden.blogspot.com.
Highly.
And you just dropped out while you were spelling it.
Oh, fantastic.
Again.
numinousden.blogspot.com.
All right. Awesome. Thank you both.
Sir. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
All right, to take you out, we're going to go with Psyche Corporation. This is Nightmares off our CD, Crypts and Codes. See you next time.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes. En grand secteur de primavera. Give me the night. Death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. No ammunition.